And now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, mild-mannered but accused of murder. One of the men charged in last year's sniper rampage goes on trial.
IBM is in court. Two retired workers say Big Blue knew they worked with hazardous chemicals.
And a son of Osama bin Laden is reportedly alive and well in Iran. Is he also running Al-Qaeda from there?
Also, using book sales to take the measure of our divided nation.
No liberal comes in and says, oh, I can't wait to read Bill Riley. And nobody on the other side, I mean, they scorn Al Franken if they're fans of Bill O'Reilly.
These stories and Americans' obsession with secondhand stuff coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Supreme Court has upheld state laws letting doctors recommend marijuana for medical use. The decision rebuffs White House efforts to stop doctors from prescribing the drug. Graham Boyd directs the ACLU's Drug Policy Litigation Project. He says doctors will also be allowed to discuss marijuana with patients.
The Supreme Court has cleared the way now for doctors in all of the western states that have medical marijuana laws to go ahead and talk to their patients about marijuana, to recommend marijuana where it's medically appropriate. And for us, that's a victory for medical care and also for the First Amendment.
The White House had sought to punish doctors for recommending or possibly talking about the benefits of marijuana with patients. Nine states currently have laws legalizing marijuana for medicinal use. A suicide bomber detonated a car packed with explosives near the Turkish embassy today in Baghdad. The U.S. military says at least 10 people were wounded. The attack comes amid widespread Iraqi anger over Turkish plans to deploy troops in the country. NPR's Deborah Amos says today's bombing appears to have been carefully targeted.
One of the members of the Iraqi Governing Council was in the Turkish embassy at the time of the explosion. He'd been invited for lunch, talking over with the Turkish ambassador the prospect of Turkish troop deployment to Iraq. Abdul Mahdi is one member of the governing council who is against that deployment. Most of the members are. That's what they were talking about today when the bomb went off.
The only death apparently connected to today's car bombing is that of the apparent suicide bomber. The attack is the second in just a few days in the Iraqi capital. The transit strike in Los Angeles got started a full day earlier than expected. Up to 500,000 commuters are scrambling to find another way to work. From member station KCRW, Eric Roy reports.
Amalgamated transit union leaders have not said why they jumped the gun on a strike they'd been threatening to start at midnight tonight. In fact, the mechanics union leadership hasn't said much of anything since early yesterday. That's caught some commuters unaware that the strike was on, shutting down buses and light rail lines run by the Metropolitan Transportation Authority of Los Angeles County. Suburban bus lines that go into downtown L.A. are still running, but often don't run on the same routes as MTA buses. Long-distance train commuters who normally transfer to the MTA's Red Line light rail line at Union Station may be able to catch special Red Line buses. Other people are driving, further jamming L.A. area freeways, and some people just can't get to work. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 15.5 points at 97.48. Trading is light. The NASDAQ Composite is down more than 4 points at 19.29. The S&P 500 is down 3 at 1,042. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Bank of America is reporting stronger quarterly earnings despite an investigation of its mutual fund businesses. Scott Jagow of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte.
Bank of America's profits were up 31% in the third quarter as all of the bank's major businesses reported gains. Earnings exceeded what Wall Street expected by 22 cents a share. It was a strong quarter, even though the bank had to sock away $100 million to pay for the ongoing investigation of Nations Fund, the bank's mutual fund arm. A former Nations Fund broker has been charged with larceny and illegal trading. Two other bank employees were fired. Although the scandal hasn't deflated profits so far, it may in the future. The bank has promised to reimburse shareholders who lost millions because of improper trades. For NPR News, I'm Scott Jagow in Charlotte.
The Food and Drug Administration is hearing witnesses discuss silicone breast implants today at a Washington hearing. Several women are urging the FDA to keep its ban on the silicone implants. Some discussed their medical histories. However, silicone breast implant maker Inamed Corporation wants to resume offering them in the United States. Silicone implants remain legal in Europe. The Supreme Court is considering a case that looks at how phone companies can be sued. There is a law that requires regional phone companies to open up their networks to rival companies. A New York AT&T customer has sued. He is claiming that Verizon Communications did not properly open its network to AT&T, his provider. The regional phone companies insist the law does not say they have to help their rivals, and the law doesn't foster good competition. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop introduces I Heard It on NPR, Shake These Blues, a compilation of blues tracks by musicians featured on NPR programs at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In the white button-down shirt and tie of a conservative office worker or a bank clerk, 42-year-old John Allen Muhammad appeared in court today, one of two men accused in last year's murderous three-week shooting rampage in and around Washington that left 10 people dead. Muhammad told a judge in Virginia Beach, Virginia, that he understood the charges against him, which could bring the death penalty. Thelma Lebrecht of the Associated Press is covering the trial. Thanks for joining us, Thelma.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thelma, you were able to hear John Allen Muhammad on an audio feed from the courtroom. What was your sense of his demeanor?
Very mild-mannered, very quiet, not the sort of person who would lead someone else in a string of shootings, a very soft-spoken, quiet voice, definitely subservient to the judge. It was a person who was obviously being coached to be very careful about what he's saying.
And he pleaded not guilty.
Pleaded not guilty to all counts.
Now, what is your sense of it, Thelma? Did they have a mountain of evidence or not as much evidence as you might think?
That's a very good question. The defense attorneys before this trial began said that they are ready to go. They've done extensive preparation. They're anxious to defend the case. They contend that since there is no evidence that he pulled the trigger, that they can actually make a case that he is not guilty of these capital offenses. And, of course, it is the younger sniper suspect, Lee Malvo, who's undergoing a separate trial next month in a nearby town, Chesapeake, who actually will face the murder charges. And it was in Lee Malvo's case that he allegedly told people in jail that he, in fact, did commit the crime.
How long could the trial of John Allen Muhammad take?
They're estimating that by the end of December. Of course, they say it could go faster than that. They expect the jury process to take at least several days. They're not giving an estimate of when the opening arguments might be made in the case, although the best guesstimate might be next Monday, perhaps. Of course, then the case will proceed very slowly, and once they do, in fact, convict him, then there will be a separate sort of trial with the same jury to find out whether, if convicted, he should then get the ultimate sanction, the death penalty. So there will first be the conviction in the case and then deciding whether he would get the death penalty.
Now, Thelma, are the two cases linked in the sense that if John Allen Muhammad is found guilty, that would darken the case against Lee Boyd Malvo and vice versa?
The defense attorneys are trying not to link the case. However, the interesting thing about the Malvo case is that his attorneys are using the defense of insanity, saying that he was indoctrinated by the elder Muhammad and that the reason that Malvo took part in these crimes was that it was basically Muhammad's influence on him and that he was basically insane at the time of the commission of the crimes.
Now, the killing that he's accused of in this particular court didn't happen in Virginia Beach. Why are we in Virginia Beach?
A very good question. It's 200 miles from Virginia Beach that this occurred at 1 year ago. It was October 9th in the town of Manassas. That's in northern Virginia. But the trial was initially got underway in the town of Manassas, but the judge there said that all of the extensive publicity about the sniper case undoubtedly tainted the jury pool, and therefore they had the trial moved south here to Virginia Beach. Now, the interesting point is that many in here in Virginia Beach still also can commute to the Washington area. Many of them actually work at the Pentagon, so they are not that far removed from the Washington, D.C. area. Still, nonetheless, the defense and prosecutors are hoping, they say, they'll get a jury pool that will try the evidence strictly on the evidence and not what they've seen or heard about the publicity in the trial.
Thamela Brecht, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thamela Brecht from the Associated Press joined us from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
In California's Silicon Valley, the heart of the computer industry, two retired IBM employees with cancer are taking Big Blue to court. They claim that IBM knew that they and other employees exposed to chemicals while making computer parts were at risk. IBM denies it. The case is the first of 200 similar cases against IBM to go to court, and it's being closely watched by the semiconductor and chemical industries. Joining us on the line is attorney Mark Breakstone, a product liability lawyer with the firm Breakstone, Whiteleaf & Gluck in Boston. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
First of all, how significant is this case?
This is a very significant case that could have dramatic impact on an industry that employs tens of thousands of workers around the country in the chip manufacturing process.
Tell us, are there questions as to whether or not the chemicals were dangerous, or is it simply that IBM knew that they were dangerous?
It's the latter. These are well-known dangerous chemicals, some of which had been removed from the process in the early 90s. And the question is whether or not IBM knew they were exposing their workers to unusually high levels of these chemicals and failed to disclose that information and take corrective action. Hmm.
Well, one of the retirees who's suing contracted breast cancer after 14 years making IBM computer disk drives. The other got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma after nearly 30 years of making big boards for disk drive computers. IBM says these cancers could have been from other factors, such as smoking. How difficult is the case of the employees to prove?
Well, it's a very difficult case because there are so many people in society that suffer these diseases who are not exposed to these chemicals, and that raises the plaintiff's claim that there is an unusually high cluster of victims of these illnesses, and cluster theory cases are very difficult to win.
Right, and in fact, the plaintiffs lost a battle last week when a judge threw out the corporate mortality file. This is the statistics the company kept on the mortality rate of employees from 1969 to 2000. An epidemiologist hired by the plaintiff said the statistics showed that IBM employees died from cancers at higher rates. But as I said, the judge threw that file out. And in any event, as you point out, it's very hard to prove, even with an epidemiologist saying that it's right there in the books.
Yeah, it would have been a tremendous benefit to the plaintiffs to admit that evidence. But there are other published studies in the medical literature that establish links between these chemicals and the diseases that the plaintiffs claim to have suffered. The real issue is whether or not the plaintiffs can show that IBM knowingly and fraudulently concealed this information from its workers and failed to provide a safe workplace.
Right. Is there any other way for them to show that? Maybe their personal files, because these plaintiffs saw doctors on site. They saw IBM doctors.
There must be other ways, because if this is the only study upon which the plaintiff's claims are based, then the plaintiffs would have no case. And the fact that the cases are going forward indicates that there are other studies and other expert opinions upon which they will base their claims.
Yeah. Well, Mark, in the few seconds we have, as a product liability lawyer, we said the industry is watching this, but as you point out, so are thousands of workers. What do you think is going to happen?
I would be surprised if this case goes to verdict. I suspect it will be settled, and it will be settled for sums that will not be disclosed, and I think it will have a ripple effect throughout the industry.
Meaning?
That I think other cases will be brought and settled as well.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Breakstone is a product liability lawyer with the firm Breakstone, Whiteleaf & Gluck in Boston, Massachusetts.
And this note, the Supreme Court said today that it will decide if four words in the Pledge of Allegiance are unconstitutional. The words are one nation under God. They're, of course, recited daily by millions of school children across the country. A California man who's an atheist says the words send a message that real Americans believe in God. He sued to have the words removed. The High Court will hear the case sometime next year. Back in the 1970s, Congress decided that it was cheaper to care for the elderly when they're ill in their own homes. So to encourage seniors to stay home, contributions to help pay for such care, copayments, were eliminated. But now, as the House and Senate struggle to create a $400 billion compromise bill on Medicare by the end of this week, some want to reinstate those copayments. Joining us to discuss the federal Medicare bill and copayments for stay-at-home care is Stuart Altman, professor of national health care policy at the Heller School at Brandeis University in Massachusetts. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Professor, thanks for joining us. The idea of reinstating the copayments is, of course, to help pay for the mammoth costs of Medicare. But eliminating the copayments was intended to save money by caring for the elderly at home. Did that not work, or is it just that even good ideas are threatened now by a desperate need to raise money for Medicare?
Well, I mean, the fairness would be that it's sort of overworked. I mean, we really have a much more extensive home care benefit under Medicare today than we did in the 70s. Matter of fact, home care spending was one of the fastest growing items in the 1990s in Medicare.
I see. So it is, in the end of the day, about raising money. It worked, but it worked almost too well.
Yeah, that's right. And also there were more and more concerns that some of the people that were using home care were sort of abusing the issue. There are parts of the country where people were just using it almost extensively and just not stopping. And actually it turned out to be more expensive benefits than if they had gone to the hospital.
I see. Well, what kind of copayments are they considering?
Well, there are various potentials that are being thrown out. Some of them are talking about a $35 to $45 for, or even $50 per episode.
Per episode?
In other words, it could be over a period of time, not per visit. Uh-huh. An episode could be several visits, so it's much less per visit.
Now, that doesn't sound like too much, but I guess it's a lot to someone who's old and on a fixed income.
Well, yes, it is. Although it is fair to say that our poorest citizens under Medicare are covered by Medicaid, and therefore they would not have the copayment charged to them. This is a tricky issue. There is good arguments on both sides. It's partly a revenue generator for the prescription drug benefit, but it's part of a way of sort of slowing down the growth in home care services. And we had this debate once before in the 1997 balanced budget, and the home care agencies really argued strongly against it. But what they got was even worse. They got a reimbursement rate which was so low that it actually destroyed a number of home health agencies. So it's not an either-or situation for them. It may stave off cuts again in their reimbursement.
Professor, what's your sense of where this is going by Friday when they're supposed to have that compromise bill?
Well, my sense is that the Republican-dominated conference will impose a modest copayment. I'm not very optimistic, however, that the bill itself will pass. So the reality is that it'll probably go down along with a much-needed benefit.
And President Bush will stand with the Republicans?
Well, it's hard to say. He's making a lot of noises that he really wants this legislation, but a lot of the people who I respect in Washington say he's really not pushing that hard and not really pulling out all his chits to make it happen.
Stuart, you follow this so closely. Let's broaden our conversation just to finish up. Are we going to have a Medicare compromise bill on Friday, or could this whole thing go down in flames?
Well, I think the betting is that it's significantly less than 50%. There are some really major structural and ideological differences both between the Democrats and the Republicans and between the House and the Senate. So I would put it no more than 20% that we're going to have anything.
Professor Stuart Altman is a professor of national health care policy at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Professor, thanks so much for joining us on this.
Oh, thank you, Bill.
Just ahead, protecting your computer against viruses and worms.
And later in the program, why exactly are there so many Christopher Cross albums at garage sales, and other observations about secondhand America.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Internet usage has jumped in the past year, but according to the VeriSign company, which released the latest numbers this week, at least some of that increase may be due to the spate of computer viruses and worms that flooded the net in August. One of those malicious worms spread to more than a million computers and carried inside it a message to the founder of Microsoft. Billy Gates, why do you make this possible? Stop making money and fix your software. Well, our regular Internet commentator David Weinberger joins us to tell us whether such a fix is even possible. Hi, David.
Hello.
Well, I understand, first of all, that Microsoft is at least part of the problem. And why is that?
Well, for one thing, Microsoft is simply the fattest pig around. So, you know, if you want to do some damage, that's who you go after.
Something of a monopoly.
It could be. Microsoft also has a set of technical issues that every week they're addressing and patching up, all sorts of holes that virus makers exploit. But the real and deepest problem with Windows, Microsoft Windows, is that it wants to be an integrated place. That is, it wants to let you use the stuff you write in your spreadsheet, move it right into your word processor and into whatever. So
yeah.
Because it's integrated, that means it's designed to let one program operate another program automatically. And that's exactly what viruses do. And that's not a hole that Microsoft can patch.
Right. Well, let's talk about what can be done. There's a Microsoft initiative called the Trusted Computing Initiative.
Yes. It's an attempt to make sure that your computer is like a fortress. It means getting new software and new hardware. But once that's done, according to this initiative that's been underway for a while from Microsoft, only things that you know, recognize, and approve of will run on your computer.
Okay.
So that has some hope for taking care of spam and taking care of viruses, perhaps. But it has another side that has many of us a little concerned, which is it means that in your fortress computer, the content from Hollywood,
Music,
all the stuff you're going to be downloading increasingly in the future, that's going to be the source. That stuff will run on your computer according to the rules that the people you're buying it from have set up.
In other words, it's a fortress against outsiders, but potentially also against you.
Absolutely. And that means that the unholy alliance between Hollywood and Microsoft, the convicted monopolist that so many of us have feared, becomes a little realer with this Trusted Computing Initiative.
Couldn't someone just switch to a non-Windows, you know, non-Microsoft computer?
Absolutely. And you have legions of Macintosh users who will cheer you on. So that's a very real option.
What's the downside?
Well, because a tiny percentage of users use it, there's much less software being written for it. And that's perhaps the biggest downside.
What else can Microsoft users do?
Well, the usual things, which are make sure that you have a good virus checker and that it's always up to date. Make sure that you're downloading the appropriate Microsoft updates, but only doing it from the Microsoft site. Never open email that says there's a patch or an update.
Yeah.
Microsoft does not distribute them that way. And in fact, be extraordinarily careful opening email attachments.
David, thank you.
Thank you.
David Weinberger, Here and Now's regular Internet commentator. For more, visit our website, here-now.org.
The New York Times top 10 nonfiction list this week is all politics. Conservative commentator Bill O'Reilly is in first place. His liberal arch nemesis Al Franken is number two. And so it goes all the way down the list. How to Lose Weight, Make More Money, and Fire Up Your Sex Life books once dominated nonfiction lists, but they've got a category all their own now, leaving books not only remarkably political, but polemical. Paul Krugman and Molly Ivins on the left, Laura Ingraham and David Limbaugh on the right are all authors who get the blood boiling of people who disagree with them. Is that anger the pulse of the nation beating on its bookshelves? Let's ask Betsy Ryder, the owner of Otto Bookstore in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Hi, Betsy.
Hi.
Betsy, does your bookstore's sales of political books reflect the Times list?
Yes, it does. But once you give up weight and sex, there's not much left for politics.
Not much left for politics. That's a little scary.
Yeah, it is. But, although I'm sure the weight loss is selling faster than the politics.
I see. So are you selling more political books than usual, though, this season?
Oh, definitely. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody says they're the only ones that are telling the truth and the others are lies.
So are people seeking the truth on the other side to try to understand how other people think, or is it just the converted wanting to be preached to?
Nobody wants like that? To read the other side. Everybody's reading what they believe already.
How do you know that?
Oh, from the enthusiasm with which they buy the book. Uh-huh. No liberal comes in and says, oh, I can't wait to read Bill Riley. Bill O'Reilly, and nobody on the other side, I mean, they scorn Al Franken if they're fans of Bill O'Reilly. So you can tell.
Betsy, Pennsylvania will be an extremely important state in the presidential election of 2004. Can you pick up any vibes out there in Williamsport that indicate which way the state may swing?
I think it's going to be touch and go as to whether Pennsylvania goes this way or that.
You know, Betsy, when you work in a bookstore, you do sort of have your finger on the pulse. You kind of get a sense of the zeitgeist. Are we an angrier country than we were a couple of years ago? Most of these books are angry, sarcastic.
Well, I think the Democrats have a better sense of humor.
Oh.
They're more humorous about things.
I see.
I mean, Michael Moore's books and Stupid White Men and everything, there's more laughs to it. O'Reilly doesn't have a laugh in the book, I don't believe, although I can't say because I haven't read him. I don't agree with him.
Well, there you go. You see, you're just reinforcing this whole trend.
Oh, I know.
I think you ought to pick him up and give him a try.
Well, I suppose I could, but people like myself like to read other books.
Well, listen, let's finish up then. Any recommendations for somebody who'd like to get away from all this nonfiction and reality?
Oh, yeah. The Da Vinci Code is a really tight read. You're held by the seat of the pants all the way through.
That's Dan Brown, right?
Dan Brown.
Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code for anyone who wants to step away from our roiling political angers and resentments. Betsy Ryder, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for calling.
Betsy Ryder is the owner of Otto Bookstore, a book lover's paradise since 1877 in Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, one of Osama bin Laden's sons is living in northern Iran and reportedly directing some of Al-Qaeda's operations from there.
Bolivians protest a plan to send natural gas to the United States.
And secondhand stories. Two filmmakers go yard sale to yard sale to show America's obsession with used stuff.
We found some kinky cuffs at a garage sale, which were some sort of light S&M fur-lined handcuffs, which a woman didn't seem to have an explanation for why she had them.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. Another car bomb exploded in Baghdad today, this one in front of the Turkish embassy. The driver was killed and more than a dozen people wounded. The latest in a string of bombings to hit the Iraqi capital comes as many Iraqis are angry over Turkish plans to deploy troops. Lourdes Navarro is in Baghdad.
That was seen as an unpopular move within the country, specifically amongst the Kurdish minority, which has been struggling inside Turkey for its independence. And equally, many among the governing council viewed having troops from a neighboring country as complicating efforts here.
Lourdes Navarro reporting from Baghdad. A senior Russian official indicates his government wants to make some changes in the U.S. draft of a new United Nations resolution in Iraq. The draft resolution does not meet the demands of Russia, France, and Germany for a speedy handover of power to an Iraqi provisional government. Jury selection is underway in the capital murder trial of Washington, D.C. sniper suspect John Muhammad. The judge has excused 11 of the first 40 jurors. Muhammad has entered not guilty pleas for murder, conspiracy, and firearm charges. Logan Airport today becomes the first airport in the nation to screen cargo for explosives and other contraband. Audie Cornish reports from Boston.
The MOVIX, or mobile X-ray machine, looks like a large commercial truck, except with a long arm coming out and over the side. That arm is equipped with cameras and small boxes that emit X-rays not much stronger than what you might receive at a doctor's office. The difference is that the radiation lasts much longer as the vehicle's arm passes over cargo trucks. The security firm that's funding the effort is providing at least three of the $1 million MOBIX vehicles for a 30-day trial. Congressman Ed Markey today applauded the effort, saying it disproves claims by the airline industry that widespread cargo screening isn't financially feasible. Markey says a small fee could be added to air tickets to pay for the added security. I'm Audie Cornish at Logan Airport.
Delta Airlines will sell nearly a dozen planes to offset a $168 million loss in the third quarter. Company officials say the results are better than expected, but are still a long way from good news. The airline has laid off 16,000 workers since the 2001 terrorist attacks. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are down. The Dow was down 23 points at 97.41. The Nasdaq is down 5 points at 19.29. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A son of Osama bin Laden and a small group of top Al-Qaeda officials are living in a remote corner of Iran and from there directing terror operations around the world. According to two reports in today's Washington Post, Western and Arab intelligence organizations say the small group is protected by a secretive Iranian security unit called the Jerusalem Force that operates beyond the control of the central Iranian government. Dana Priest and Douglas Farah reported today's stories, and Dana Priest joins us on the line now from Washington. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, let's start with the headline, Osama's son, Saad, S-A-A-D. What do we know about him?
Well, we believe that he's the second oldest of the sons, and that he was born in Saudi Arabia to bin Laden's one of his favorite wives, that he grew up pretty much at his side in Afghanistan when he formed al-Qaeda and traveled with him to Sudan when he lived there for a while. So he really grew up at his knee as he was forming some of the, the al-Qaeda terrorist network.
And is he growing in strength? Has his role been growing?
Well, we believe it has, according to U.S. and European intelligence officials. We don't think he's the leader necessarily, but he's one of a handful of important al-Qaeda leaders' structure that is still in, that is operating in Iran under the protection of this Iranian force.
And, in fact, may have had a hand in, for instance, the Riyadh bombing in Saudi Arabia.
That's right. There's indications that there were contacts right before then between the group in Iran and the Riyadh bombers.
Well, what about the al-Qaeda operatives that he, Saad, seems to be with? Who are they?
Well, they're the about two dozen of the top al-Qaeda leaders outstanding who are being monitored but also protected in Iraq. I say monitored in that we don't think that they can move around quite as freely as you might imagine, that they are under the protection but also the control to some extent of the Iranians who are holding them there.
Is it thought that their reach, as far as their leadership reach, extends beyond, let's say, Saudi Arabia? I mean, what impact can they have from northern Iran?
Well, yes, it does. People do think that they have some sort of command structure there and are able to communicate some way. Mainly, we think through couriers and not through telecommunications or computers, with adherents still around the world. How far flung that is, I don't know, but it is the one concentration of al-Qaeda leaders that we know about in the world.
And then we have this Jerusalem force. As you write, it's the Iranian group that protects the al-Qaeda operatives. It's not under the control of the more, some would say, moderate Iranian government, but it's under the control of the hardliner clerics.
Right, and their main function, they're one of five branches of the Revolutionary Guard, and their function is to export the revolution, even to groups that don't share the fundamentalist Shiite brand of Islam popular in Iran. So they are allowed to go out and form alliances and train and arm groups that are Sunni, for example. Mm. And in that way, they are considered the most dangerous components of the guard force.
So, Dana, what do you think is going to happen? Do you get a sense that either the moderates in the Iranian government might take on the clerical hardliners, or that a Western nation or other nation might perform a commando operation? Do you get a sense of what might happen?
I think the stakes for a commando operation would be pretty high, especially given the instability right next door in Iraq. But it is very much a question mark right now. I hate to be so ambivalent about it, but that reflects the dual-track thinking within the United States government.
Well, Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dana Priest covers national security affairs for The Washington Post.
Bolivia is the poorest country in South America and also one of the richest in natural gas. But a plan to build a gas pipeline from Bolivia across Chile and to the Pacific has been met by violent and now deadly protests. The gas could mean $1.5 billion a year for Bolivia in exports to the U.S. and Mexico. But Bolivian unions say the money would never reach the poor. The unions demand the natural gas industry be nationalized. Joining us on the line is Philip Withersgreen. He's a freelance journalist based in La Paz. That's where he joins us from. Welcome, Philip.
Hello there, Bill.
What's the mood in La Paz today? Demonstrations?
The day started relatively quietly compared to yesterday, but a lot of people out there, lots of angry shouting and confrontations with police who are trying to control the situation.
What's the death toll so far from these demonstrations?
Officially, there have been no figures released. We're talking at least 50, and that's likely to increase as more people are discovered, as it were, because many parts of the city are no-go areas. It's very hard for authorities to get there, and it's very hard for people to get their dead out, as it were, to morgues and hospitals.
No-go areas in La Paz, what do you mean?
Well, there are boulders across many of the roads. Infrastructure such as footbridges have been blown up with dynamite and collapsed onto roads, so there's no vehicular movement whatsoever.
This is an extraordinarily violent turn of events for Bolivia, right? This is unusual.
I've been here 10 years, and this is the worst of this kind of violence I've ever seen here. Many people reminisce about the days of the dictatorships and the chaos that existed in Bolivia in the late 70s and early 80s as the nearest comparison.
Now, Philip, what is the status of this, what would have been a $5 billion pipeline project?
Effectively, it's on hold. The president, Gonzalo Sanchez Lozada, said yesterday that he would make no decision over the gas until he had carried out a full and thorough consultation with the people and got their approval for it, which he put a deadline on as the 31st of December this year.
Philip, what are Bolivians' problems with this pipeline, which could have brought so much badly needed revenue to the country?
Essentially, Bolivians throughout their history, have had foreign companies and foreign interests take the best of what Bolivia has to offer out of the country in a raw material form. None of this stuff is processed here or refined or industrialized here. It doesn't create jobs. It doesn't really create value for Bolivia. And Bolivians see this as their last best hope of ever having some kind of an industrialized employment base.
Now, how much trouble is President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada in? Even his own vice president, Carlos Mesa, has broken with the government. Approval ratings around 8%, we read.
Yes, he's in a great deal of trouble because he heads a coalition of three parties, and either of his coalition partners could abandon him at any time if they consider that it's not worth staying electorally in the future. It would do more damage than good by staying in power. And he would obviously, if that happened, be so weakened that he would be unable to continue.
Mm-hmm. Still, it looks like weeks still to come, at least, of turmoil in Bolivia.
Indeed it does, because the main opposition leaders have said that they will not talk to the government, they will not talk to the president, because they insist that he must resign first before any conversation can go on. And so we face a standoff here, the president refusing to resign and the opposition refusing to talk.
Philip Withersgreen, thank you very much for joining us.
My very good pleasure.
Philip Withersgreen is a freelance journalist. He spoke to us from La Paz, Bolivia.
Still to come, garage sales, auctions, thrift stores. We'll look at America's love affair with secondhand things.
You're listening to Here and Now. There are now alternatives out there to the controversial Barbie doll. If you're a Muslim or are looking for a more conservative doll, look towards Razan, a doll being heralded as the Muslim Barbie. Joining us on the line now is Amar Sadeh, creator of the Razan doll. Hi, Amar.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for joining us on this. First of all, so our listeners can picture the doll, describe what Razan looks like and what she wears.
Razan is a Muslim doll. It wears the headscarf plus the hijab, which is the jilbab, which is a cover for the body and the head.
Now, are there different kinds of Razans for sale? As with Barbie, you know, she can be, I don't know, I guess a cheerleader and a bride and whatever else Barbies are?
The way we are trying to present the doll or the Razan doll is we want it really to build the character of Muslim girls in our communities. We are trying to focus on helping our girls look at the inside much more than the outside. This is why when we made the doll body, we tried to make it like a preteen body much more than, you know, a mature woman body, to make the whole focus on the inside much more than the outside.
What do you hope to accomplish with the doll?
Well, there are a few things we are trying to deliver or accomplish with the doll. One of them, as I mentioned, is to build, to focus on building the character. And this is where we believe as a company that the worth of any human being, not only Muslims, is the inside of themselves and what they can contribute to their society much more than the outside shapes and colors and covers and so forth. That's one thing. Second, we are really hoping that our Muslim kids or girls will have higher self-esteem when they play with the doll, see it, that they will feel that, well, you could be something. You could be a teacher, you could be a doctor, you could be whatever you want to be, even though you are wearing this headscarf and this jilbab or this dress. Another thing that we are really trying to promote diversity. You know, our dolls come into three different skin colors, you know, black, white, and olive skin color. And this is also another message we try to teach our community and other communities, you know, that people are people regardless of their skin color or how they look from outside. We're really hoping that to enlighten our kids, and when I mean kids, our kids, I mean all kids, Muslims and non-Muslims, about other cultures and about other faiths. We really would love to breed tolerance among our kids. They grew up with it, so they would accept the differences they have among themselves, and they would try to work on building our societies here within the U.S.
Amar, why did you think it was important that the Razan doll not be as physically well endowed as the Barbie doll is?
The Barbie doll focuses a lot on the how the body looked, and let's face it, I mean, how many women they look like the Barbie doll? For the past 2 days, I mean, we got huge, huge response from non-Muslims, how they agree with us about this.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful idea, Amar. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
And thank you very much for having us on your shows, and thank you again.
Amar Sadeh is creator of the Razan doll. His company is Noor Art Incorporated from Livonia, Michigan.
There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Christopher Wilcha and John Fryer had a dream. So they bought a used 1977 Chevy ambulance on eBay and set off to look for America in her garage sales, thrift stores, auctions, anywhere where secondhand stuff is sold. In fact, their film on Secondhand America was made by Secondhand Equipment and features a soundtrack of old albums purchased in their travels. Called Secondhand Stories, the pilot episode of what they hope will be a series airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. And they both join us, Chris Wilcha from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
And John Fryer is also on the phone from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, John.
Hello, Robin.
John, start with you because we talked to you a while ago.
Yeah, just last year, I think.
Right. You wrote that book, All My Life for Sale. You sold everything you owned on eBay and then you visited your stuff. And I guess it just illustrates your fascination with things bought and sold. What is that fascination?
I'm captivated by the idea of where things came from and where they went. Obviously, All My Life for Sale was focused on object histories that, and my personal relationship with the things that I owned. And I, you know, was really interested in continuing that theme in terms of, you know, I was always finding stuff and wondering where it came from and who previously owned it.
And luckily you have a friend named Chris.
That's true.
Who is equally interested.
Exactly.
So, Chris, what is it about you and garage sales?
Well, I think similar to John, it's a bit of a personal obsession, both as a kind of act of pop culture archaeology, but also, you know, there are many pleasures in secondhand consuming. And I think one of the fun things about going to thrift stores and garage sales is that it's inevitably always a treasure hunt. It's never, you know, you never go there trying to buy something you need. Mm. You go there to find things you didn't even know existed.
And probably don't need. You realize when you get home. Chris, do me a favor. Just tick off, like as a, in a laundry list, some of the memorable items that you came across.
We found some kinky cuffs at a garage sale, which were some sort of light S&M fur-lined handcuffs, which a woman didn't seem to have an explanation for why she had them. We found something called the Wobble Light, which was a failed industrial prototype that, you know, we sort of saw magic in. We found, you know, the soundtrack to the last 20 years, you know, all this vinyl that's floating around that much of it hasn't been reissued.
Why are there so many crisscross sailing albums at garage sales? I thought it was a nice song.
Yeah, well, you know, I think pop culture has a cruel way of rendering a verdict in the form of thrift store inventory.
You know, either that or you know, people replaced all his albums with CDs.
Let's hope.
That's a much more generous
Let's hope. Hey, John, you also visit some estate sales, and as you say, this is a unique combination of commerce and mortality, and also a poignant one. Let's listen to a clip of someone in New Jersey. He's talking about his late cousin while all of his cousins, many collected cameras and egg beaters are spread out. And here's what he has to say about, you know, seeing someone's life laid out on a junk table, really.
His passion in life was going to garage sales, flea markets, camera shows, you name it. It's sort of endless what you all had. You know, one of the other relatives had said, you know, Paul really didn't have much of a life. And it might not have been the life that I would have chosen or someone else would choose, but it was a life, and it seemed to work for him.
That's the thing with estate sales and even estate auctions. You just have this opportunity to see this snapshot of somebody's life.
Yeah. Chris, I wonder, too, sometimes you actually hear the person. I can't believe how many answer machines still had their tapes in them, and how many people throw away home movies.
Yeah, I was sort of have been endlessly shocked by how people are completely comfortable dispersing really intimate artifacts from their family, personal family archives into the world of thrift. And how, you know, an answering machine tape is kind of one of those accidental things that maybe you forget when you throw away your answering machine, that in fact there's the residue of all these exchanges and all these conversations.
Hi, guys. It's Lou, and I'm not going to be able to be at church tonight. I've got a flu bug or something.
David, it's Lisa. I got to take my mom and dad to see Neil Diamond tonight, so I should be home around 11.
You almost need to put a muzzle on them, don't you? They can't keep their big mouth shut. The younger they are, the more they talk.
But, you know, home movies and stuff like that, I'm always shocked and kind of always speculate as to how this thing may have ended up in a thrift store or a junk shop.
Yeah, there's one scene the ambulance that you drove served a few purposes. You could hit tennis balls against it. You also watched these old films against it. And it was so surreal to see these people. I immediately wanted to know, who are these people? And you take us to meet some of the people behind some of the stuff.
One such person was Robert Evans, who was a retired bus driver who ended up having to sell off his record collection because he was moving. It was kind of a sad but really interesting way to look at all of these records and his entire taste of music that he had collected over the years.
When you get over 700 albums, it takes up quite a bit of space. And I'm just getting tired of moving them. I just hate to get rid of them, but I have no other choice. As I grew up with vinyl, it's like giving up a family member or, you know, a friend.
Well, Chris Wilcha, you and John had no problems letting go of some of your newfound stuff when you needed the money.
One of our conceptual goals was to see if we could have a little bit of a self-sustaining road trip. So the idea was that we would buy things in one place and try to sell them in another place to help pay for things like gas and lodging. I get very attached to things, but I've tried lately via collecting images and videotaping to try to have that be the purchase in and of itself. In other words, you know, I collect an image of it instead of actually buying the thing, and that way my apartment is still, you know, I can still inhabit it.
Right, because we're just drowning in stuff. And we are, but still people stepped up to the plate when you had your sort of garage sale. I mean, you had it out of the back of the ambulance, but here are some of the people who bought some of your things.
My name's Chris, and I purchased this fine collection of ribbons from Camp Scuffy.
We bought this
canister of 8mm film, and we have no idea what's on it.
Well, I've been trying to start a band, and I have a guitar, but it doesn't have any strings on it, and this one has some strings, so.
My name is Mario Pina. I just like this.
What exactly is that?
I don't know.
My name is Ashley Fraser. I bought the kinky cuffs.
John or Chris, jump in on this. Was there anything you came across? I mean, maybe it was Marvin Gaye singing Broadway tunes or that great skateboard, John, that you got. Was there anything you just, you know, you said, I have to keep this. I can't let go of this.
Well, we haven't sold the skateboard yet. So I've been holding on to that, but I think we'll have to get rid of that in the future.
I mean, the ambulance itself, I think we grew to know and love in a way. I mean, our initial goal was to sell that as well and kind of close the loop, but I think we tried to sell it and we didn't get an offer. Although, bizarrely, a guy wanted to buy it for his catering company, which still makes me completely uncomfortable that he'd be selling food out of the back of a used ambulance.
In fact, speaking of the ambulance, there was actually a terrorist alert while you were filming. It involved two men trying to illicitly get an ambulance to perform a terrorist act, and so you got stopped everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere we went. You know, Chris and I had read something in the paper about these terrorists attempting to buy an ambulance in northern New Jersey in cash, and it was on the same weekend that we were going to buy an ambulance in northern New Jersey for cash. So it was quite a scary moment. Almost every state we drove into, as soon as we drove in, somebody would pull us over. But as soon as they looked into the back of our ambulance and saw the various things that we bought from garage sales, they were less alarmed and led us on our way.
You were just going to commit, you know, flea marketing.
Exactly, flea marketing. We're professional flea marketers. So,
well, at the end of the pilot, which again airs tonight, you're still begging. I mean, you know, you are a secondhand series potentially.
True. We there's no guarantee of our future. PBS is putting it on and seeing what the viewer response is. So any viewers are much appreciated.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and it sure isn't your father's antique roadshow.
Certainly not.
It's a whole different
putting
thing.
Putting the anti in antiques roadshow.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Christopher Wilcher and John Fryer are co-creators of Secondhand Stories, scheduled to air tonight on PBS stations around the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Don't write about this song. I love this song. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And you can mail us. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Author and attorney Scott Turow on how freeing an innocent man changed his position on the death penalty.
And a group of New York artists long for the bohemian art scene of yesterday.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.